Hello, and welcome to Tide Talk, bringing the events in the East to the rest in the West. Today, with Dr. Brian Collins of Ohio University. For any of those who have not had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Collins, he has been here in Athens since 2013. He is the current department chair of the Classics and Religious Studies Department, as well as a chair in Indian Religions and Philosophy. On top of those accolades, he is an associate professor in our Classics and Religious Studies Department and teaches various courses on Southeast Asian topics, mainly religion. Finally, he received his PhD and Master's in the History of Religion and Religious Studies from Chicago University. But that's enough from me. How's your semester going, Professor?
Oh, it's going. It's everything's sort of coming into the end. You know, that's how it always goes.
It appears both students and professors are very done with the semester. We're going to take a small departure today from our more geopolitically oriented questions to do more cultural related questions because Dr. Collins is very well read and very well experienced in this. So as far as the format, same as usual, a few questions, a couple minutes to answer. And whenever you're ready, Doctor.
I'm ready.
All right. Question number one. What is your experience with the Eastern and specifically the Eastern side of culture in the Asian region? What is your experience with that?
So I'm looking at the question that you emailed me. It says specifically, where have you been around the region? So you're asking about my travels in Asia? Okay. I have only ever visited one country in Asia, and that's India. So I've been, my first trip to India was in August of 2001 to do a Hindi study abroad program there. And that was based in North India, mostly Delhi, Rajasthan, Jaipur. Well, the state of Rajasthan, the cities of Jaipur, and it was basically throughout the region of Central and North India. And then I spent about a week in Calcutta before I returned to go to graduate school. And ever since then, I've been going back as often as I can. Since I've been at Ohio University, I've gone back about every other year. So it's 8 or 9 trips in total. Most of them spent either in Delhi, Mumbai, and central Maharashtra, which is where we have our study abroad. And my most recent trip was actually to the southwest region, the border of Maharashtra and Goa. It's called Sindhudurg. And that was my last trip to India. So I've been going there for a long time, mostly in the central and the north part, but also some travels in the south.
Most of these have been academic, or have they been for pleasure?
Well, they've all been academic. I think, yeah, they've all been academic. So it was either language study, Sanskrit and Hindi, or dissertation research, or leading study abroad, or most recently for a research for an article or book project. So it's either been research or pedagogy.
Okay. Moving on to question two. What cultural generalizations do you think most Americans hold over Asia? And I guess specifically to you over India, do you have any sort of specific pet peeve?
Well, I think the biggest one is that people think everything is sacred. Everything that comes from India specifically has some sacred significance because there's a sort of a generalization that India is a very religious place. Well, which is true. Religion is a huge part of life in India, but I think it's hard for people to wrap their minds around things about India that don't have to do with the sacred. So every sort of clothing and music and film, everything is sort of treated as if it's some sort of a holy relic sometimes. And it's, you know, the place is not a museum. There's 1.3 billion people there who live and work and play. And so India has a very, very diverse culture. And while religion is important to it, it is not the only thing that goes on there.
Is there anything in the other direction that you've noticed as far as how Indians hold of Americans?
Well, I mean, I think, well, beyond the sort of blanket generalization of India as a religious place, people think that it's a, but, you know, I think it's like this with everywhere that you don't spend much time. You assume that it's kind of homogenous, that it's the same throughout. And I think people in India assume that about America, too. So if they have family in America, they're usually in a place like Chicago or New York. And they or a few places where a lot of South Asians have settled. And so they don't have a very good idea of the diversity within the U.S. And so they tend to ask questions of if the whole country was an extension of New York City or Chapel Hill, Cary, North Carolina, or something. So that's I think, though, goes both ways. I mean, without significant experience, we all just default to a kind of a presumption of sameness. And so that I think we see that there, we see it here, just a lack of appreciation for how wildly variegated things are within the culture in the country.
In your experience, how many different cultures do you think you've interacted with?
In India?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's it's very, I mean, there's been people there for a long, long time. There's four distinct language families represented there. Of course, the Indo-European in the north, which came from Central Asia around 1500 BCE, but then the Dravidian language family in the south, which has been there longer, the Austroasiatic languages, which we see scattered throughout South and Southeast Asia, and Sino-Tibetan languages, which are spoken in the Himalayas, in the hill regions. So just linguistically, it's incredibly diverse. And I mean, it has two official languages, Hindi and English, and then I think 16 constitutionally recognized regional languages, and then hundreds of dialects, which might as well be languages. So that's just linguistic. And then Hinduism as a sort of a uniform religion doesn't exist. You have places where worship of Kali is everywhere. Others where the worship of Ganesh is everywhere. Others that are strongly Sunni or strongly Sikh. There are big Jain communities, Catholic communities, and that's religion. And then politically, you have Marxist parties, you have religious nationalist parties, you have hardline Islamist groups. So politics, religion, language, ethnicity, and of course, caste, tribe, clan, there's just a lot of everything. I don't know how many cultures there are, but probably you could argue there's a new culture every 100 or so miles.
I've been reading personally about hijras, or I apologize if I mispronounced that, in terms of gender studies for them, and that has blown me away because that canon is long and complex, and I'd love to learn more about them, to be honest.
Yeah, the third gender, recognized third gender of India. Yeah.
Moving on to question three, though. In recent times, we have seen the rise of Indian and South Korea cultural exports on the big screen. Films like Triple R and Parasite have exploded in popularity and have received a multitude of awards. Why do you think regional competitors like China falter in this category?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know a lot more about, I don't know as much about Indian cinema as other people do, because it also is a lot of diversity there. So people think about Bollywood as Indian cinema, but it's not even the largest regional cinema in India. So Telugu and Tamil language films are probably bigger. Marathi films are pretty huge. And then of course the Hindi based film industry, Bollywood, based out of Mumbai, formerly known as Bombay, which is where you get the Bollywood from. And India has always produced a lot of movies ever since the film technology was introduced there. And they've also exported them. So Indian films from all regions, with the exception of Bengali realism, which sort of looks kind of like a Italian or French Italian realism or French New Wave, is known for its spectacles of song and dance, and also for certain kinds of supernatural genres, like one of the famous ones is the Naga movies about snake people, these sort of snake fairy tale people who can turn into humans, but they're also snakes and they're a figure of mythology. But all over the world, those films have been exported. They can be translated into any language, and because they focus on spectacle and music, and because they're also all family-friendly for the most part. Countries that have censorship boards, they can just take an Indian movie and pretty much put it right on the screen, sometimes not even bothering to translate it. So that's why it's become so popular around the world. I know in Ghana, you see a lot of Bollywood movies and a lot of movies about the Nagas. So that's, I think, why. I mean, a friend of mine, he used to be a professor here. He's from Jordan. Says that was the movies everybody watched, because in a Muslim society, you didn't have to worry about censoring out any sexual content or violence, and so they would just prefer to have an Indian movie that could just go right to the screen. So RRR is just the latest of their attempts to corner the market for global cinema, and that, you know, has been a big one. I think it's the biggest budget Indian film of all time, and I think it might be coming up to being the biggest film of all time, Indian film of all time, outside of as far as a non-Indian audience.
I've been dying to watch Triple R. It's been glowing reviews, and some of my favorite YouTubers have done endless talking about it. Do you have any preference in terms of the cinema background, personally?
Of Indian cinema?
Yeah.
Well, I actually like the sort of knockoff horror movies that they made in the 80s and 90s. Those are a lot of fun. I've spent a lot of time reading about those and collecting the posters and the lobby cards and the song booklets that are used as promotional materials for those. So those are sort of a cult movie within India, but in a cult, and they have a cult following outside of India. So those are my favorites, and they actually are getting kind of a new audience. They're getting put out on Blu-ray. The Ramsey brothers, the most famous filmmaking family of Indian horror, have had a sort of a renaissance and are being the subject of scholarly attention right now.
I can speak personally from my experience in Mandarin that taking in media as a part of learning a language is really important, you know, being able to hear it, say it, take it in. Have you used any sort of media in that matter to really nail in the languages?
Well, I have. Mostly the language, I haven't studied any language formally in a long time because I've been a professor for a while, and I don't have the time anymore. So, but when I go back to India, it comes back to me after about a week. Hindi. Hindi's the only language that I've ever had any facility with. I've tried to learn a little Marathi, but I think my brain's too old for that. So I studied Sanskrit. Nobody speaks really. A few people speak it, but artificially, whereas Hindi is a language spoken throughout North India, but is nowhere in the South, and usually not even in the East. So it's only a limited use, but in places like Delhi, which is one of my favorite places in India, then Hindi's useful. Sometimes when I get back and I feel like my Hindi's pretty good, I will watch YouTube videos for a while, but then, you know, that becomes... It becomes tiring too. So yeah, I think that if you want to learn the language, movies are a good way to do it. But the best way is to just go to a place where you have to learn the language. When I was learning it in college, I went to Indian grocery stores and practiced there.
Okay. We're moving on to question four. Given that you are a specialist in Buddhism, where do you think the religion, if you can call it that, as we've discussed in my class with you, will end up in the near future United States? What do you think an Americanized Buddhism will look like?
Well, Yeah, so my knowledge of Buddhism is mostly of Tibetan and Indian Buddhism, but I do have some experience with Americanized Buddhism, and you know, Americanized Buddhism to me is not significantly different from Tibetanized Buddhism or Koreanized Buddhism or Bhutanized Buddhism, wherever Buddhism has spread. It has become absorbed into a local culture, language, power structures. And so Japanese Buddhism is very different from Sri Lankan Buddhism. Korean Buddhism is very different from the Buddhism that is practiced in Myanmar. So in fact, you know, Western scholars for a couple of generations didn't really put it together that all of these traditions around Asia were Buddhism. They called the Buddha different things. The Buddha looked wildly different from one region to another. Some Buddhas looked like Greeks, like in the Gandharan region where Alexander the Great's generals converted to Buddhism. Other times they look like a Chinese deity. And in fact, they are just a Chinese deity, like Guan Yin in China. So that's actually Bodhisattva. But the point being that Buddhism has done nothing but rapidly change and be adapted into different cultural contexts. So Americanized Buddhism is one among many of the forms that Buddhism has taken over the past, 2,500 years or so. So I think it will be English based, probably. Americanized Buddhism tends to be very text study oriented and meditation oriented, and less oriented towards devotional practices like, you know, worship and prayer and holidays, festivals. So it's a very intellectualized pursuit, and it's spreading though beyond cities and highly educated groups into other populations. So a lot of people are looking now at African American Buddhism and its spread. And there's one book, and then there's a book, a collection of essays, and then another book on this. So how it'll look, I don't know. But it won't be any less or more Buddhist than any other form of Buddhism that has developed.
I will be locked in to see as it expands. I mean, we already know that other more traditional, if you can, big quotation marks on that, religions in the United States, Christianity, Judaism, their membership is starting to very sharply fall off in the United States, and watching newer things fill that void, Buddhism being one of them, as their numbers have increased greatly in the U.S. I would like very much to see where that goes, maybe even seeing how it adapts to Christian practice. That, I think, will be a very big topic in the coming decades. But moving on to question 5. What draws you towards your study in India and in Tibet and the rest of your specialities? Is there anything that you want to know more before you call it quits?
Well, to be honest, sometimes I think I don't have I don't know what I would do next in India. So I spent a long time studying the Sanskrit Mahabharata, and I'm still to some extent doing that and publishing the last of my work on this, on the epic poem, the Mahabharata, which is one of the sources of classical Hinduism, probably the biggest source of classical Hinduism, and still a really important document and in living tradition today. But I have become recently more interested in village Hinduism, actually. So when I was last there, I was visiting temples associated with a god named Vaital, who has got snake fangs and is generally nude and carrying a sword and a lamp. And he's basically a ghost. He's called a ghost god. Bhutraj, and so he's used he's an oracle, but he also breaks curses and helps to sort of keep the various ghosts that cause problems in a village in line. So I've become really interested in the role of ghosts in Hinduism at the village level. and especially this figure Vaital, ghosts in possession. And what sort of occurred to me is that a lot of the things that we think about Indian religion, Buddhism or Hinduism, about the liberation of the self through meditation or through the action of a god, is of no consequence to the vast majority of people who today practice and probably always practiced. They're much more concerned with their daily lives and with protection from the evil spirits that they encounter around the world. So that is the core of most of the religion practice in India today. It's about curses, counter curses, ghosts, and local deities, not deities that are up in some heaven, but deities that are actually in the town or sometimes seen and heard, appear in dreams. This is a kind of religion that I think has been going on in India and most other parts of the world for a long time. It's not about faith or what you believe, but rather what people experience. Many people in America don't have experiences like that, but many do. But they just don't have it in the same context as you do in an Indian village.
Do you ever think you'll reach the bottom of the barrel in terms of material to research and discuss with other scholars?
Well, I don't know. Obviously I could always keep going. The study of India has become contentious though over the last 10 years as Hindu nationalists have gained power and especially Narendra Modi, and in some ways the atmosphere has changed. So my friends there, my colleagues there, and we talk about it that it's a little bit for those of us who've been going to India for a while and have seen the sort of changes that have happened, the kind of a hardening of the edges sometimes of conflict between different groups within India, specifically Hindus and Muslims and Hindus and secularists. I'd rather look at something old, ancient, and not have to worry about the complications of the present. But, what can you do? The world changes all around you all the time, and hopefully it will change in a way that I think will be more helpful for the people of that country, which I do. I love. I love the people there, and I love the place, and I want the best for it. I think that there are better ways to do that than what India has been has done lately.
That's where I stay in my little classics and history bubble, where I don't have to think about the icky modern things that are scary. I stick in my little area and I don't think about it. That's my piece. We're reaching around our end recording mark. So before I do the call off, is there anything you'd like to say to the listeners or plug any new recent work?
I will be teaching Hinduism in the fall. It's my favorite class to teach, and I haven't taught it in a while because I've been the chair and I've had a reduced teaching load. So I'm looking forward to getting back to it, and hopefully somebody can, maybe somebody will hear this and enroll.
Thank you for your time, Professor. And I hope to see you again in the future on the podcast and on the newsletter. And thank you for sharing your expertise.
Thank you.